Well, hello everyone. I hope you've been enjoying Carlisle Day so far. I'm joined by Mr. D and Furious Pertinax. Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing on this fine day?
I would say good, but I mean, since it's Carlisle Day, I should be a bit more grumpy about everything.
Pertinax, how are you doing?
Well, I've hardly slept in this morning here, so I'll be appropriately grumpy for Carlisle Day.
And we're going to be looking at five quotations over the next hour. Now it was going to be 10, but it's because of the way that Carlyle writes, you really need a few paragraphs from him to kind of, I don't know, really get the flavor of what he's saying a lot of the time. So I've cut it down to just five. And we're going to read them. And then we're going to think about what he says and react. We have a 1 hour 60 minute time limit, as Howard Finkel used to say, because at the end of this hour, the interview with Curtis Yarvin will air, and I have kind of scheduled us into a corner here, gents. So there can be no fat. So, Mr. D, are you ready, sir? With the first quotation, I've taken this one. That three of the quotations are taken from the Latter Day Pamphlets, which is his kind of late reactionary masterpiece written in 1850. This first quotation is from the first essay in that book called The Present Time. Would you like to give us a rendition, Mr. D?
Yes, I will do my best. I've had a little bit of practice, but forgive me if I have a few stumbles because this is as if you're familiar with Carlyle's prose, it has a very, it has a wonderful quality to it. All right. Certainly emancipation proceeds with rapid strides among us this good while, and has got to such a length as might give rise to reflections in men of a serious turn. West Indian blacks are emancipated, and it appears refuse to work. Irish whites have long been entirely emancipated, and nobody asks them to work, or on condition of finding them potatoes, which are of course indispensable, permits them to work. Among speculative persons, a question has sometimes risen. In the progress of emancipation, are we to look for a time when all the horses are also to be emancipated and brought to the supply and demand principle? Horses, too, have motives, are acted on by hunger, fear, hope, love of oats, terror of plaited leather. Nay, they have vanity, ambition, emulation, thankfulness, vindictiveness, some rude outline of all our human spiritualities, a rude resemblance to us in mind and intelligence, even as they have in bodily frame. The horse, poor dumb four-footed fellow, he too has his private feelings, his affections, gratitude, and deserves good usage. No human master without crime shall treat him unjustly either, or recklessly lay the whip where it is not needed. I am sure if I could make him happy, I should be willing to grant a small vote, in addition to the late 20 million, for that object. Him, too, you occasionally tyrannize over, and with bad results to yourselves, among others, using the leather in a tyrannous, unnecessary manner, withholding or scantily furnishing the oats and ventilated stables that are due. Rugged horse subduers, one fears they are a little tyrannous at times. Am I not a horse and half brother? To remedy which, so far as remediable, fancy the horses all emancipated, restored to their primeval right of property in the grass of this globe, turned out to graze in an independent supply and demand manner, so long as grass lasts. I dare say they are very happy, or think themselves so. And Farmer Hodge, sallying forth on a dry spring morning with a sieve of oats in his hand, an agony of eager expectation in his heart, is he happy? Help me to plough this day, Black Dobbin, oats in full measure if thou wilt. No, thank, snorts Black Dobbin. He prefers glorious liberty and the grass. Bay Darby, wilt not thou, perhaps? Grey Joan, then, my beautiful broad-bottomed mare. Oh, heaven, She too answers, "Rrr." Not a quadruped of them will plow a stroke for me. Corn crops are ended in this world. For the sake, if not of Hodge, then of Hodge's horses, one prays this benevolent practice might now cease, and a new and better one try to begin. Small kindness to Hodge's horses to emancipate them. The fate of all emancipated horses is, sooner or later, inevitable. To have in this habitable earth no grass to eat, in black Jamaica gradually none, as in white Connemara already none, to roam aimless, wasting the seed fields of the world, and be hunted home by chaos, by the Jew watchdogs and Jew hell dogs, with such horrors of forsaken wretchedness as were never seen before. These things are not sport. They are terribly true in this country at this hour. Between our black West Indies and our white Ireland, between these two extremes of lazy refusal to work and of famishing inability to find any work, what a world we have made of it, with our fierce mammon worships and our benevolent philanderings and idle, godless nonsense of one kind or another. Supply and demand, leave it alone, voluntary principle, time will mend it, till British industrial existence seems fast becoming one huge poison swamp of reeking pestilence, physical and moral, a hideous living Golgotha of souls and bodies buried alive. Such a courteous as gulf communicating with the nether deeps as the sun never saw till now. These scenes, which the Morning Chronicle is bringing home to all minds of men, thanks to it, for a service such as newspapers have seldom done, ought to excite unspeakable reflections in every mind. 30,000 outcast needlewomen working themselves swiftly to death, 3 million paupers rotting in forced idleness, helping said needlewomen to die. These are but items in the sad ledger of despair.
Well, a fantastic rendition, D. So this is, I would say, some fairly typical Carlyle. Furious Pertinax, you asked me before the stream, do you feel like you're leaving out any gems? Honestly, you could just pick out any Carlyle almost at random and it would be of that sort of, you know, of the kind that that D just read out. Now I'll just point out some like typical features of this, because just in this passage you can see quite a lot of his usual kind of complaints. Like he hates, like he was obsessed with something called the condition of England question. And this essay, you know, it was called The Present Time. And for him, the problem with Britain ultimately was that it had lost faith of any kind. It had lost the kind of true meaning of life in transcendence, which then leads it to look for, you know, all sorts of kind of quack remedies, as he puts it. One of his least favorite, was laissez-faire economics. Okay, so hence, so he keeps on going on about supply and demand. Another one of the things he absolutely hated was democracy, which is ostensibly what he's attacking here. Another thing that he hated was the principle of nomadism, that is the prospect of all of these poor people, the 30,000 distressed needle women, the people from the West Indies, the poor Irish, etc., basically having to move to look for work. He hated that. So all of these things are registered here, but in, you know, some pretty interesting language, let's say. So Furious, I'll hand over to you first. What did you make of this passage?
Well, the ending of it is definitely a a sledgehammer of sorts to what we would understand today as sort of consumerism or as materialism. He certainly makes position very clear in his summary there of, you know, the outcast needle women working themselves to death and the 3 million paupers rotting in idleness, you know, helping them die. And if one is to reflect on what conditions were in the industrializing British Isles, you know, during Carlyle's lifetime, and I suppose all one has to really do is have generated a Dickensian mental image of what England was at the time.
I should mention, Furious, that Charles Dickens was profoundly influenced by Carlyle. In fact,
that doesn't surprise me in the least.
I mean, Dickens read the Latter Day pamphlets, and you know, sometimes you can see him directly picking up like names and images, you know, in books like Hard Times. And so, I mean, Dickens was kind of like a Carlyle disciple in some ways, just in terms of this question. I also mentioned that where this has some relevance for today is that obviously a lot of people on the right care about immigration, right? And obviously, you know, the economic argument has always been, well, you know, supply and demand will sort it all out, you know, and people will, it'll actually be for the better. You know, it's the E.M. Penner argument that I had recently, you know, the line will go up ultimately. But Carlyle's contention was always that, you know, all of these poor people will move over from Ireland or the West Indies or everywhere else. And the net effect actually will be that they'll drive the wages of everybody down, and that in the end you'll end up with, you know, the working poor being even more abject than they are, because now they have to compete with like Irish scallywags or even black workers. Carry on.
Good point. Definitely the point about labor was quite important, because at this time too we're having a phenomenon which occurs during industrialization is obviously urbanization. Cities such as Birmingham and Manchester and London itself and many other places in England rapidly growing population as a result of this sort of pursuance of the industrial job which was occurring in these expanding industries. And Carlyle was obviously a witness, an observer of this, and he's sort of like more or less critiquing it in real time. And the point I was sort of making about Dickens as well is that, you know, sometimes we in our modern time have an amnesia of quite recent history, and these are the needle women and the paupers of England. They are English people suffering the tumult of this process of industrialization, and in some ways Carlyle is rightfully exposing one of the soft underbellies of the material consumerist argument, is that despite this promise, there is very often in one way or another an inseparable cost that comes with it. And for these ideologies, because at this point in time, sort of, you know, Marxism had become a thing, and socialist ideology was being sort of mulled over and conceived of and thought amongst intellectual circles. And again, you know, whether it's in the sort of the Anglo-liberal tradition in the British or American context or in the sort of continental Marxist notions, they're purely addressing materialistic conceptions. And what sort of Carlyle is saying is that there's obviously more to groups and to societies, and sort of in what he mentioned about who was it, the West Indies and Ireland, is that, you know, okay, everybody and every creature to some degree can have base motivations, base compulsions that sort of come along with simply being an animal or a species or a creature or a person, right? But that doesn't make the person. There is something more that is missing in almost sort of in these false promises that come with the material and the consumer sort of the image that he's painting here.
We can come back to this after I bring Dee in, but you know, Milton Friedman And a lot of the free market economists, you know, would point out, they'd be like, yes, Carlyle, but if you look at real workers' wages, 1800 to 1900, you know, they increased in real terms by 90%, by which they mean they, you know, you could buy, you could get more bang for your buck, your basket of goods, you know, a pack of sugar or whatever in 1900 would be cheaper than 1800. But Carlyle never cares about that. In fact, he outright says, it's like, you know, is it worth it? Basically, is it worth, like, so what? Like, he understands the economic arguments. He often makes a quality argument. He says, yeah, okay, you can make cheaper goods, but the quality has gone down. You know, these needle women, for example, he frequently says that they can't sew. You know, so instead of having a dedicated, you know, live-in seamstress or a, you know, a master weaver or something,
or a dressmaker, yeah,
you know, now you've got these wretches doing it for the cheapest, you know, for the cheap and nasty, as he calls it. So
mass production to the dollar kind of mindset.
Yeah, he is not persuaded by those sorts of economic arguments. He also has a chapter in Chartism called Statistics, where he points out that all of the because one of the things that people will forget about Carlyle is that he had a background in mathematics. Like, before he embarked on his writing career, he studied maths, and he even wrote a kind of pretty famous textbook, which is still distributed in some places, on mathematics. So he understood the how figures works. He understood statistics, and in this chapter in Chartism, he basically says, like, there are all sorts of issues with trying to, you know, make these arguments based on average wages. Like these needle women, for example, he's like, well, look, if they have decent work for, you know, 3 months and they can live well on that 3 months, okay, that goes down in the thing. But what about like the two months where they're looking for work? What about when they have to move? What about, like, what about the difference between wage rates in London and wage rates in Leeds? And so he basically just points out all of the problems, you know, with aggregate wage stats. And he basically says, listen, all you have to do is go and take a walk in London. And I mean, you mentioned Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens was famous also for doing exactly that, for going out late at night and just seeing what life was like. Carlyle was very much of the mind of, you know, don't tell me not to believe my lying eyes, professor. You know, the statistics can tell me all sorts of things. I can see there are, you know, 50 beggars living down there. Yeah. Anyway,
the real world is showing me this. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, we can kind of see it now. Like, I mean, even now, I've noticed a huge increase in homeless people, you know, in the past decade. Definitely.
Yeah. My city too. Yeah.
Dee, would you like to comment on this passage, sir?
Well, see, the one image that struck me is the bit in the second paragraph where he begins in his sort of wonderful analogy with the horse and the emancipation of the horse, and he puts that line, "Am I not a horse and half brother?" And if people aren't familiar with what he's referring to there, I actually collect Wedgwood china, it so happens that Josiah Wedgwood, the founder of the company, it was a very one of the wealthiest industrialists of the 18th century. He actually produced a medallion for, I believe it was called the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. Wedgwood, you know, in his factory, in his factories producing ceramics, produced a small ceramic medallion of a black slave in chains with the motto, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And these became like enormously kind of popular amongst, you know, the kind of well-to-do classes of the time, you know, where ladies wore them as, you know, hairpins and lockets and such. And it was part of a, you know, a sort of a campaign for the abolitionist cause, because Wedgwood, I think, was a Unitarian, and so was sort of intimately involved in that. So that the fact that Carlyle was sort of bringing that up kind of subverting it in a deliciously cruel way, certainly really struck me.
Yeah, and with that horse passage, that there are another kind of few like typical features of Carlyle. One is that I think you have to realize that he delighted in upsetting polite society. And at this point in his career, in 1850, so believe it or not, Carlyle was friends with almost all of the big names in Victorian liberal society, including John Stuart Mill. In fact, he was very good friends with John Stuart Mill, to the extent where he entrusted Mill with the first manuscript of The French Revolution, of Volume 1, which, as I mentioned before, his maid actually thought was rubbish. Mill's maid thought was rubbish and put it in the trash. And Carlyle had to rewrite the entirety of the first volume of The French Revolution again. But, despite that, he didn't fall out with Mill. Until this time, where, Carlyle had basically been saying the same sorts of thing for a decade at this point. So, I mean, to put it in context, Chartism, he wrote in 1840. He wrote this in 1850. And how can I put it? Like, you know how Peter Hitchens, since like Cameron, has gone like, he just kind of laughs and he's just gone like, he's like a pure black pill merchant now. He doesn't really, he has no like, he kind of, he thinks like England is just doomed, basically, you know.
Carlyle, yeah, the advocacy has ended. It's basically he's no longer trying to push a kind of viewpoint.
So the idea by this point in his career is that Carlyle had resolved to be in a minority of one, right? So he basically didn't care who he offended. But it's worth recognizing that he's actually doing this from a position of being like in the epicenter of Victorian society. He had that house in Chelsea, which is still there. You can go and visit it. And basically anyone who was anyone in the kind of intellectual scene of London at that time went to visit Carlyle. But when he started writing stuff like this, one by one, all of those friends kind of, started to slip away a little bit. And Carlyle was starting to be seen like being a quote out of touch with the times or whatever, a reactionary, in other words. In this bit about the horse, I think you can see a pretty deep analysis or mocking satire of John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism. He keeps on like, are they happy? Are they happy? He hated Bentham and Mill's kind of hedonistic idea of, well, yeah, the happiness of the most people, that's going to be the measure, and we're going to do it through material means. So he's kind of saying like, you're reducing men down to the level of horses here. And what's to stop us, applying the same principles down to horses? And it's kind of funny, look, if you think forward to people like Peter Singer and like animal rights activists, people literally make these arguments.
This reminds me, just recently there has been a campaign. I just saw it the other day, a campaign to declare animals as basically given personhood, given the status of personhood.
We've arrived at it then.
I mean, what was deliciously biting satire of the day? I mean, he could never have imagined that the well that he saw England and certainly the UK descending into was bottomless.
Quite.
Yeah. So I mean, and the other thing is that obviously he's mocking the horses and so on. But I mean, I think it's pretty easy for people to think like, this is just like straightforward, like racism or whatever. But he's not saying that. Like, you've got to understand he is saying that we've already got like 20 million idiots living in the country, right?
Yeah.
Now we're going to add like Irish idiots to them. And now we're going to add like Black West Indies people as well. It's like, you know, it's just multiplying the problem, if that makes any sense. What these people need, he argues, is, you know, wise leadership. You need like a, not a bloody farmer who's just going to be constantly thinking like, are the horses happy? You know what I mean? Anything else on this, or shall we move on in the interest of time?
The latter, I think.
All right. So now we have, I think I've picked this from the next one in Latter Day Pamphlets, which is Model Prisons. This is where Carlyle goes and visits these new prisons that they'd built, and gives a like pretty vivid description of seeing all of the prisoners in the cells. Dee, do you want to read this one?
Yes. In fact, it was too clear this excellent man had got a feel for his faculties, which, in several respects, was by no means the suitable one. To drill 1,200 scoundrels by the method of kindness, and of abolishing your very tread wheel, how could any commander rejoice to have such a work cut out for him? You had but to look in the faces of these 1,200 and despair, for most part, of ever commanding them at all. Miserable, distorted blockheads, the generality, ape faces, imp faces, angry dog faces, heavy, sullen ox faces, degraded underfoot, perverse creatures, son of indelicity, greedy, mutinous darkness, and in one word, of stupidity, which is the general mother of such. Stupidity intellectual and stupidity moral, for the one always means the other, as you will, with surprise or not, discover if you look, had borne this progeny, base-natured beings, on whom, in the course of the maleficent subterranean life of London scoundrelism, the genius of darkness, called Satan, devil, and other names, had now visibly impressed his seal, and had marked them out as soldiers of chaos and of him, appointed to serve in his regiments, first of the line, second ditto, and so on, in their order. Him, you could perceive, they would serve, but not easily another than him. These were the subjects whom our brave captain and prison governor was appointed to command and reclaim to other service by the method of love, with a tread wheel abolished. Hopeless forevermore, such a project. These abject ape, wolf, ox, imp, and other diabolic animal specimens of humanity, whom of the very good gods could ever have commanded them by love, a collar round the neck, and a cart whip flourished over the back, these, in a just and steady human hand, were what the gods would have appointed them. And now, when by long misconduct and neglect they had sworn themselves into the devil's regiments of the line, and got the seal of chaos impressed on their visage, it was very doubtful whether even these would be of avail for the unfortunate commander of 1,200 men. By love, without hope, except of peaceably teasing Oakham, or fear except of a temporary loss of dinner, he was to guide these men and wisely constrain them. Whitherward? No whither. That was his goal, if you think well of it. That was a second fundamental falsity in his problem. False in the warp and false in the woof, thought one of us. About as false a problem as any I have seen a good man set upon lately. To guide scoundrels by love. That is a false woof. I take it, a method that will not hold together. Hardly, for the flower of men will love alone do. And for the sediment and scoundrelism of men, it has not even a chance to do. And then to guide any class of men, scoundrel or other, know whither. Which was this poor captain's problem. In this prison with Oakham, for its one element of hope or outlook. How can that prosper by love or by any conceivable method? That is a warp wholly false, out of which false warp, originally false condition to start from, combined and daily woven into by your false worth or methods of love and such like, there arises for our poor captain the falsest of problems, and for a man of his faculty the unfairest of situation. His problem was not to command good men to do something, but bad men to do, with superficial disguises, nothing.
Well, thank you very much, Dee. And would you like to come in first on what you make of this? Again, the vivid, the imagery is so vivid. I mean, the context for this in model prisons, Carlyle is basically making this argument that the modern conception of justice is all wrong. You know, both the rehabilitative justice, he has this character called Fiddlestring, right, who's this philanthropist and humanitarian who kind of supports all of these you know, right on causes like abolitionism and, you know, reforming the prisons and so on. And as you can imagine, Carlyle has nothing but contempt for such a person, sees them as kind of vapid and as a creature of fashion, really. But also that this doctrine in itself is like perverse and ultimately evil. But he goes a step further in this essay. He basically says, even the retributive justice that people think of, where you're going to kind of try to use a system of like incentives, you know, and disincentives, and like have that as the principle of crime prevention or whatever, is already thinking about the problem in the wrong way, because justice ultimately is God's revenge on evil, which is just like a completely different conception of what justice is meant to be altogether. And he thinks that the London of his time has completely forgotten this. I was also going to mention very quickly that Carlyle believed that you can kind of judge a society by the sorts of heroes that it erects. And I couldn't help but notice the sorts of heroes that our society worships now.
Yes, one is reticent to skip back to the distorted blockheads, ape faces, imp faces, heavy sullen ox faces.
And just as tellingly, too, the heroes that we tear down, as we are guilty of in modern society, moreover.
Yeah, and so what I was thinking though, when what I was thinking though, as Dee was reading this, was that look at where the doctrine of kind of showing love to the criminals has got us. Like, do you think Carlyle could have ever imagined the sorts of crime rates we have now, like in places like Chicago and London and LA, and this is literally the product of this doctrine of, you know, showing the criminal more and more love that he's talking about here. But anyway, Dee, I don't want to take up all the time.
Well, I mean, certainly what strikes me, I mean, you mentioned Jeremy Bentham, but of course, Jeremy Bentham certainly was involved in, you know, in the late 18th century with the idea of kind of reconceptualizing the notion of a prison, you know, the notion of punishment with the panopticon. And of course, also there was the Penitentiary Act, I believe it was called, in the late 18th century, where it certainly was a big cause for Quakers and such. I mean, all of this to change the idea of punishment, you know, which at that time would have been certainly, you know, more on the side of vengeance than on and retribution than on reformation, you know. But I mean, and of course, just changing the word from prison to penitentiary, you know, the penitent, the person seeking, you know, seeking indulgence and dispensation from the their sins. It was strangely much, like the things that we've seen in our day. This campaign to sort of change the nature of the language, to change the nature of our conception of what had been, sort of ancient concepts that helped keep civilization civilized. To see these be eroded away for kind of political campaigns, it's not a new thing, and certainly happened in Carlyle's day and slightly before. So he would have been sort of still reacting to this, and it was still an ongoing thing. I mean, transportation and of course the death penalty being two things that they were aiming their sights at. And of course, again,
that's the other big thing. Fiddlestring is campaigning against capital punishment. Fiddlestring, yes. Abolitionism, prison reform, and capital punishment.
And of course they achieved all their aims. And look, I think you look about you if you want to see the results of that. So I mean, of course, again, I'm struck by the language there. I mean, the whole passage where he's sort of making this allusion to weaving, to the warp and the woof. And of course, then having the echoes where he had the litany of kind of negative images of a wolf and an ox, and the kind of wolf and woof and weaving, and the way he was weaving those passages together. I mean, people really should read Carlyle, if for anything else, to understand how to make a very powerful and literary argument. This I think is almost just, as so much of these pamphlets and bits by Carlyle is that they're almost just rants, but they're just pure elegantly assembled rants. But
just before I bring in a Furious a second, I should mention that the ox face and the wolf face and all that sort of stuff, Carlyle did have this idea called spiritual optics, where we actually believe that the more kind of spiritually degraded a person was, the more it showed, in their physiognomy, which is kind of has only very recently become an odd idea. I talked about that in my American BC video a couple of weeks back. But anyway, Furious, any thoughts on this passage before we move to the next one?
Two very quick points, and one you just sort of more or less canvassed just now, which is Carlyle is evidently, with the use of those quite clear and definitive descriptions, is highlighting a notion of physiognomy and its correlation with behavior, which for those of us and most of us in our sphere have come across, Ed Dutton and the work that he does, and how genetic mutations express themselves without, and what you sort of see on the outside, not always, but more often than not, is present in terms of, you might say, characteristic mutations, in a sense. These things coincide with each other. And obviously their understanding of genetics was, I don't want to say non-existent, but was very, very rudimentary compared to what we, should understand now or do understand now. But that these are people who had grown up, who had lived in a time steeped in tradition, and these ideas or these concepts, like you say, what Carlyle describes as spiritual optics, is something that has been understood. I mean, to some degree, Greeks and Romans spoke about the notion in their own way.
But even now, you could go to a prison, and I reckon you'd still see, you understand exactly the sorts of faces he's talking about.
Reminds me of remember when sort of there would be these compilations of like Antifa rioters and such who had been arrested. They would show the kind of booking shots, and they're just a litany of deformities and disfigurements.
Faces of bioleninism.
I mean, pure. Undeniable. It is undeniable. And of course, but we're in an age where we're basically told to deny our senses, deny our instincts,
To deny what to your lying eyes.
Very eyes and souls tell us,
And we have to accept too that it's an indispensable component of egalitarianism. It's been one of those things which has been absolutely fundamental in lowering the guard of the common person in their ability to threat detect as well.
Now, folks, we've got 20 minutes left and 3 quotes left. What are we going to do? Right, D, you ready?
Okay.
Let's just bring out the bangers.
We're just going to have to talk less, I suppose.
Okay, I'll try to read as quickly as possible.
I believe I have taken this one from... Okay, this is from the notorious occasional discourse on the Negro question. Alternative titles are available. So, D, take it away.
And I, by the way, I'm reading Thomas Carlyle. These are not necessarily my own thoughts. Before the West Indies could grow a pumpkin for any Negro, how much European heroism had to spend itself in obscure battle to sink in mortal agony before the jungles, the putrescences and waste savageries could become arable, and the devils be, in some measure, chained there? The West Indies grow pineapples and sweet fruits and spices. We hope they will one day grow beautiful heroic human lives too, which is surely the ultimate object they were made for. Beautiful souls and brave, sage poets, what not, making the earth nobler around them, as their kindred from old have been doing, true splinters of the old heart's rock. Heroic white men, worthy to be called old Saxons, browned with a mahogany tint in those new climates and conditions. But under the soil of Jamaica, before it could even produce spices or any pumpkin, the bones of many thousands British men had to be laid. Brave Colonel Fortescue, brave Colonel Sedgwick, brave Colonel Brain, the dust of many thousand strong old English hearts lies there, worn down swiftly in frightful travail, chaining the devils, which were manifold. Heroic Blake contributed a bit of his life to that Jamaica. A bit of the great protector's own life lies there. Beneath those pumpkins lies a bit of the life that was Oliver Cromwell's. How the great protector would have rejoiced to think that all this was issue in growing pumpkins, to keep Quashy in a comfortably idle condition. No, that is not the ultimate issue, not that. The West Indian whites, so soon as this bewilderment of philanthropic and other jargon abates from them, and their poor eyes get to discern a little what the facts are and what the laws are, will strike into another course, I apprehend. I apprehend they will, as preliminary, resolutely refuse to permit the black man any privilege whatever of pumpkins till he agrees for work in return. Not a square inch of soil in these fruitful isles, purchased by British blood, shall any black man hold to grow pumpkins for him, except on terms that are fair towards Britain. Fair, see that they be not unfair, not towards ourselves, and still more not toward him. For injustice is forever a curse, and precisely our unfairness, cause the enslaved black man has, by inevitable revulsion and fated turn of the wheel, brought about these present confusions. Fair toward Britain it will be that Quashy give work for privilege to grow pumpkins. Not a pumpkin, Quashy, not a square yard of soil till you agree to do the state so many days of service. Annually that soil will grow you pumpkins, but annually also without fail shall you, for the owner thereof, do your appointed days of labor. The state has plenty of waste soil, but the state will religiously give you none of it on other terms. The state wants sugar from these islands, and means to have it, wants virtuous industry in these islands, and must have it. The state demands of you such service as will bring these results, this latter result, which includes all. Not a black island by immigration and boundless black supply for the demand. Not that. May the gods forbid, but a regulated West Indies with black working populations in adequate numbers, all happy, if they find it possible, and not entirely unbeautiful to gods and men, which latter results they must find possible, all happy enough, that is to say, all working according to the faculty they have got, making a little more divine this earth which the gods have given them. Is there any other happiness, if it be not that of pigs fattening daily to the slaughter? So will the state speak by and by. Any poor idle black man, any idle white man, rich or poor, is a mere eyesore to the state, a perpetual blister on the skin of the state. The state is taking measures, some of them rather extensive, in Europe at this very time, and already is in Paris, Berlin, and elsewhere, rather tremendous measures to get its rich white then set to work. For alas, they also have sat, negro-like, up to their ears in pumpkin, regardless of work, and of a world all going waste for their idleness. Extensive measures, I say. And already, as in all European lands, this scandalous fare of street barricades and fugitive sham kings exhibits tremendous measures for the thing is instant to be done.
Yeah, so this is towards the end of this essay, which is, I mean, it's talked about as a defense of slavery, but it's actually a little bit more nuanced than that. He doesn't support what was called chattel slavery. He actually supports a kind of version of serfdom. But the thing to understand about Carlyle is that he advocated that for Britain too. But he does have this idea that Quashy, left to his own devices, basically just won't work, and he kind of needs to be like pretty much made to work by these sorts of incentive structures that he's talking about. You know, at the risk of being non-politically correct here, folks, can anyone really look at the past like 150 years and the experience of this particular group that he's talking about in the USA, for example, you know, looking at employment rates, looking at, you know, welfare systems and so on, and not kind of see that there's a grain of a point here. Not just with that group, with all groups, basically, but, you know.
Yeah. Not just a grain of a point, a pumpkin seed of a point, I would say.
Pumpkin seed of a point. What do you think, Furious?
On that point, I'd like to perhaps emphasize that maybe when there was the possibility for a condition for which that might have been proven wrong, or may have been on a trajectory to be proven wrong, we have in the 1960s the passing of the LBJ legislation and the mass expansion of the welfare state, which you might say placated the base needs of everyone and severely distorted such incentive structures. And now you are seeing, we are seeing the consequence of that, and the absolute destitution that brings about, that, you know, the desolation of communities and families and the social deleteriousness that follows that. One of the things I did wanted to point out, because it sort of jumped at me as reading it, and that is the point where he makes about sort of the heroic white men, whether you be called old Saxons. And it reminded me of an old Roman maxim by the poet Horatius, or who do we call Horace, in that when he's quipping about sort of the Roman, the expansion of the empire and the expansion of Roman culture, he says, "What coast knows not our blood?" And in some ways, Carlyle is making an appeal of a similar kind, you know, in that he says, you know, brave Colonel Fortescue, Colonel Sedgwick, Colonel Brain. I mean, he could easily say Centurion Crassinus, Baculus, and Titus. And that to create the conditions by which to be able to grow the pumpkin and the pineapples and the sweet fruits and spices that he mentions, I mean, that doesn't arrive out of the ether. It takes very specific conditions from which to for a society to be able to arrive at the point where they can do that. And the history of settled human society demonstrates that, you know, whether you go back to ancient Sumer or Akkad or Egypt or, you know, the Bronze Age, it's very specific circumstances that lead to the conditions for that to be possible. And what Carlyle is almost hearkening to is that, you know, great exertions have been made in order to create these places around the globe, and the people who have made them are in fact great. And I suppose in the societies and the conditions we live in today, those people are being eschewed and being demonized.
Yeah, no, I mean, he says elsewhere in this essay, you know, look at what happened in Haiti. And you can remember this was in the late 1840s, he was writing this. Mm. And he basically says in this elsewhere in this essay, you know, next 100 years, Haiti's not going to do anything because of this whole issue where it's the attitude towards work, the attitude towards, you know, you need, like, you basically need to have this. And you can see, like, a bit of his Calvinism coming through as well, I guess, or at least his Calvinist, his Scottish upbringing. He absolutely saw work as a moral thing. And he constantly attacks idleness. He attacked the aristocracy, the British upper crust, basically, for absconding their duty. He mm-hmm. basically said they were do nothings and say nothings, and that Chartism and democracy and all of this kind of chaos and disorder that we see in the world were downstream of the ruling class absconding their responsibility and yeah. worshipping doctrines like laissez-faire, etc., and also just allowing, like, the, you know, the new industrialists to take over them. So he saw work as a good in and of itself, and he argues that a lot. To the extent where if somebody won't work, in his view, they should be made to work. You know, this is a little bit different from the view that we saw from Evola back when we did Evola Day. But this is a very Scottish temperament, I suppose. Yeah. But to your point, Furious, before I bring Dee in, he's saying, like, you need men with a temperament like that to be able to kind of hack the bloody plantation out of the jungle, you know. Mm. It's not going to do it on its own. You need a work ethic, you know. Anyway,
it won't hack and slash itself. Yeah.
I think the difficulty with this is, of course, Carlyle was, I think, had a foot in two different worlds. I mean, he was, you know, at once kind of sort of living and understanding a kind of more ancient view of the organization of society, but he was also living in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, such thing that the world had never seen before. And I think the problem, of course, is that, you know, the virtue of work becomes more and more difficult to kind of justify when the work becomes industrialized on the scale that, of course, began to emerge in the 19th century, you know.
And I mean, dehumanized.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's both violating the principles of the past, but it's also creating a kind of nightmarish situation where it almost requires that this sort of idea be applied to something that's almost defeating itself, you know. I mean, this idea, okay, well, you can valorize the idea of work as a virtue in itself, but I mean, at a certain point, you know, you're just creating endless streams of shite for more and more and more generations that don't want to work their pumpkins, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it is fair to say that elsewhere, as we'll see with our last two quotations, we're going to have to go over a little bit. We've got like about 10 minutes slack in the schedule. I can move Yarvin forward and move this back like 10 minutes just to buy us a little bit of space here. But he does have like disdain for the industrialists and what he calls British manufacture, which he thought was responsible for, you know, making the cheap and nasty. And I think that you have detected maybe a slight contradiction in his, like, well, why is it so important for these guys to work on these pumpkin fields then? You know, what are they doing? Like, is this not like mass production, basically? So, I mean, I do get that point.
It harkens back to the thing about Wedgwood producing the anti-slavery medallions, you know. So you have, you know, so you have workrooms full of white men and Stoke-on-Trent, you know, slaving over pottery kilns, making anti-slavery medallions for, you know, the upper middle class in London to wear as hat pins. I mean, there is something quite absurd about this weird, you know, sort of slurry of kind of Enlightenment principles And then, of course, the dark reality of what's needed to create this magical wonder world of future.
Yeah. Well, on that note, why don't we get to another Latter-day pamphlet now, which is called Hudson's Statue, where the setup for this is that they've decided in London to erect a statue to a railway tycoon, basically. as we know, and as I just mentioned, Carlyle thought it was very important to pay attention to who a society valorizes as its heroes. And as you can imagine, he's not that happy about the idea of the railway king being made a statue to. Do you want to read this one, Dee?
Yeah. All I can think of with Hudson is the fat controller.
yeah. Hudson, a real life fat controller. Yeah.
Hudson the railway king, if popular election be the rule, seems to me by far the most authentic king that has been elected by the people. So as almost none other is or was, Hudson solicited no vote. His votes were silent, voluntary ones not liable to be forced. He did a thing which men found in their inarticulate hearts to be worthy of paying money for, and they paid it. What the desire of every heart was, Hudson had or seemed to have produced, scrip out of which profit could be made. They voted for him by purchasing his scrip with a profit to him. Every vote was the spontaneous product of those men's deepest insights and most practical convictions about Hudson and themselves and this universe. I say it was not a spoken vote, but a silently acted one, a vote for once incapable of being insincere. What their appetites, intelligences, stupidities, and pruriences had taught these men, they authentically told you there. I beg you to mark that well. Not by all the ballot boxes in nature could you have hoped to get with such exactness from these men what the deepest inarticulate voice of the gods and of the demons in them was, as by their spontaneous purchase of scrip. It is the ultimate rectified quintessence of these men's votes, the distillation of their very souls, the sincerest sincerity that was in them. Without gratitude to Hudson, or even without thought of him, they raised Hudson to his bad eminence, not by their voice given one at some hustings under the influence of balderdash and beer, but by the thought of their heart, by the inarticulate, indisputable dictate of their whole being. Hudson inquired of England, "What precious thing can I do for you, O enlightened countrymen? What may be the value to you by popular election of this stroke of work that lies in me?" Popular election, with universal, with household and other suffrage, free as air, deep as life and death, free and deep as spoken suffrage never was or could be, has answered, "Pounds sterling to such and such amount. That is the apparent value of thy stroke of work to us, blockheads as we are." Real value differs from apparent to a frightful extent in this world. Try it by what suffrage you will. Hudson's value as a demigod being what it was, his value as a maker of railways shall hardly concern us here. What Hudson's real worth to mankind, the matter of railways, might be, I cannot pretend to say. Fact knows it to the uttermost fraction, and will pay it him, yet men differ widely in opinion, and in general do not in the least know. From my own private observation and conjecture, I should say trifling, if any were. Much as we love railways, there is one thing undeniable. Railways are shifting all towns of Britain into new places. No town will stand where it did, and nobody can tell for a long while yet where it will stand. This is an unexpected and indeed most disastrous result. I perceive railways have set all the towns of Britain a-dancing. Reading is coming up to London. Basingstoke is going down to Gosport for Southampton. Dumfries to Liverpool and Glasgow. While at Crewe and other points, I see new ganglions of human population establishing themselves, and the prophecy of metallurgic cities, which were not heard of before. Reading, Basingstoke and the rest, the unfortunate towns subscribed money to get railways, and it proves to be for cutting their own throats. Their business has gone elsewhither, and they cannot stand behind their business. They are set a-dancing, as I said, confusedly waltzing in a state of progressive dissolution towards the four winds, and know not where the end of the death dance will be for them, in what point of space they will be allowed to rebuild themselves. That is their sad case.
Yeah, no, furious. Have you ever heard a description of the free market quite like that?
It's very vivid and very, yeah. Carlyle pulls most punches easy. He's talking about the actual literal transformation of this of his country by railways cutting apart essentially towns and the abandonment of businesses from these towns. And it's one might say he was insightful.
I've been on that Reading to London line is still there, by the way. Been on it many times for my sins. Fucking depressing as it is.
Certainly is.
But one of the things I'll mention is that you can kind of see in this part of the logic of why he hated laissez-faire so much. Because in his mind, laissez-faire and democracy were two faces of the same coin. So he thought that you know, this principle of the market voting things in and out of existence with their wallets, you know, like in his view, the multitude are always stupid, blockheads, you know.
Yes,
blockheads. Yeah. So the will of the public, like the kind of the voice of the crowd, is going to make, you know, a Hudson. And again, if Carlyle had lived, you know, you can imagine him tutting his head at, you know, every Elvis and Michael Jackson. And I mean, God knows, who are even our heroes today, you know?
He's what we our ill call, when we talk about economics, we might call the logic of the market or the science of the market. He's actually sort of almost saying, no, it's an irrationality of market because you have irrational people partaking in the market in a sense.
Yeah, well, he's saying like, yeah, okay, they got what they wanted, but what they wanted was stupid. What they wanted was stupid.
Yeah.
What they wanted is going to create the dissolution of their towns, and it's going to create a perpetual state of nomadism, in his view.
Correct. Which in some sense, we can harken back to that first quote that we talked about, you know, the horse and the chaff or the basic sustenance of people. And sort of that's it. Like, you know, ultimately people are going to sort of delve down to a lowest common denominator in a sense. And we have seen it play out in its entirety, sort of at the logical endpoint of egalitarianism in a way. Like you say, we've gone from having heroes like Alexander and, you know, Lysander and Caesar and you know, Constantine to Michael Jackson and you know just
David whoever, Beckham kind of, or whoever
David Beckham and you know et cetera. It's just stupid, you know, like any of our political heroes. We've gone from having political heroes like, say, you know, Bismarck or Napoleon, take him or leave him, to, you know, Obama and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, like,
Donald Trump, or
John Howard or Reagan, take your pick. Yeah,
one of the things that Carlyle loves to do, and as you'll see in a different video, I talk about this in my A to Z video, is that he loved to make up characters, and I give them names, you know. And one of the politicians who he absolutely hates is called Sir Jesbesh Windbag, right? Who's friends with Viscount Mealymouth, Mr. Facing Both Ways, and the Earl of Windlestraw, right?
Very appropriately named.
But he contrasts this Windbag character with a heroic leader. He had in mind Oliver Cromwell. But what he means by heroic is Cromwell was willing to do things that were unpopular, but which needed to be done, in his view. And he just enforced his will, you know, damn the multitude, I'm a leader, you know. Carlyle kind of tends towards autocratic leaders like that. But Windbag is the polar opposite. He just kind of drifts with the winds of public opinion. And I couldn't help but think of Boris Johnson, who is the ultimate drifter in the wind, as far as I'm concerned. Like, he just, like, I mean, Johnson literally trails every policy. He leaks every policy and waits to see how the public reacts. And then is like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to do it now. Or, okay, all right, then I'll do it.
I think that's even more true of, you know, this fake right, this sort of catamite right, this controlled opposition right, in the guise of Johnson, in the guise of Cameron, in Australia, in the case, say, with John Howard. It would have been true in the United States with even Bush. And I mean, there are a plethora of other examples where, you know, they fit that caricature almost exact. And they've actually made a profitable living of being that without consequence for being wrong. And that's sort of the most disgraceful thing. And Carlyle would have turned in his grave knowing that.
Yeah, well,
the dark reality, of course, is that, you know, I mean, we are witnessing, I think, in real time, what happens when you have, when the men who have this, what you would call heroic will, are also thoroughly corrupted and evil. I mean, we have, of course, the some of the grand projects of our time, the Great Reset, climate change, you know, COVID policies. I mean, these are against even the, what did Carlyle say, the appetites and preferences of the common man, but they're pushing ahead of them anyway. I mean, I think the thing is, you don't just want a person of heroic will that's going to, you know, that's going to pursue a vision. You want somebody of a good character with a heroic will.
Yeah, that is something that Carlyle stresses time and again, that it's no good just having any old set of values.
Yeah,
it has to be the one true set of transcendent values that don't change through history, basically.
Because
everybody understands what good character is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Hudson the Railway King, of course, had his own kind of heroic capitalist will, but you know, and as Carlyle has sort of amply kind of demonstrated there, what he thought of that, you know, that sort of, you know, that the kind of will, the human will as evinced through market, you know, market forces, supply and demand, as he repeats so many times, you know, that's a sham.
Sorry, Furious, in the interest of time, let us yes. we'll return to this, because as you'll see, the final extract that I've picked, which is from Past and Present, about Bobus Higgins, the notorious sausage maker extraordinaire. let's get it, because he's like a Nether Hudson in a way, but kind of a lower grade Hudson. Let's have a look at a bit of Bobus.
For example, for example, you, Bobus Higgins, sausage maker on the great scale, who are raising such a clamor for this aristocracy of talent, what is it that you do in that big heart of yours, chiefly in very fact pay reverence to? Is it to talent, intrinsic manly worth of any kind, you unfortunate Bobus, the manliest man that you saw going in a ragged coat, did you ever reverence him? Did you so much as know that he was a manly man at all, till his coat grew better? Talent! I understand you to be able to worship the fame of talent, the power, cash, celebrity, or other success of talent, but the talent itself is a thing you never saw with eyes. Nay, what is it in yourself that you are proudest of, that you take most pleasure in surveying meditatively in thoughtful moments? Speak now. Is it the bare Bobus stripped of his very name and shirt and turned loose upon society that you admire and thank heaven for? Or Bobus with his cash accounts and larders dropping fatness, with his respectabilities, warm garnitures and pony chaise, admirable in some measure to a certain of the flunky species? Your own degree of worth and talent, is it of infinite value to you, or only of finite, measurable by the degree of currency and conquest of praise or pudding it has brought to you? Bobus, you are in a vicious circle, rounder than one of your sausages, and will never vote for or promote any talent except what talent or sham talent has already got itself voted for. Here we cut short the indicator, all readers perceiving whither he now tends. More wisdom indeed, but where to find more wisdom? We have already a collective wisdom after its kind, though class legislation and another thing or two affect it somewhat. On the whole, as they say, like people like priests, so we may say, like people like king. The man gets himself appointed and elected who is ableist to be appointed and elected. What can the incorruptiblest Bobus is elect, if it be not some Bobissimus, should they find such? Or again, perhaps there is not, in the whole nation, wisdom enough collect it as we may, to make an adequate collective. That too is a case which may befall. A ruined man staggers down to ruin, because there was not wisdom enough in him. So clearly, also, may 27 million collective men, but indeed one of the infallibilest fruits of the unwisdom in a nation is that it cannot get use of what wisdom is actually in it. That it is not governed by the wisest it has, who alone have a divine right to govern in all nations, but by the sham wisest, or even by the openly not so wise, if they are handiest otherwise. This is the infallible result of unwisdom, and also the balefulest, immeasurablest, not so much what we can call a poison fruit, as a universal death disease and poisoning of the whole tree, for hereby are fostered, fed into gigantic bulk, all manner of unwisdom, poison fruits, till, as we may say, the life tree of everywhere is made an upas tree, deadly unwisdom overshadowing all things, and there is done what lies in human skill to stifle all wisdom everywhere in the birth, to smite our poor world barren of wisdom. Make your utmost collective wisdom, were it collected and elected by Rhadamanthus, Aeacus, and Minos, not to speak of drunken 10-pound franchises with their ballot boxes and inadequate collective. The wisdom is not now there. How will you collect it? As well wash Thames mud by improved methods to find more gold in it.
Yes, thank you very much for that.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, and in that, in that passage you see several of Carlyle's kind of key ideas. Yes, hero and hero worship is good, but how are you going to get a hero out of like 27 million idiots?
Yeah.
And even if Aragorn, the one true king, returned, let's pretend Aragorn walked among us, right? Is Bobus Higgins going to be able to pick him out? Is Bobus Higgins going to pick a man like that to be the leader? He's not. He's going to pick like another idiot like himself, basically, who only cares about making more sausages and matter.
Yeah, talent.
So, the aristocracy of talent, Bobus would call it. But talent for what? Making more. I mean, it's quite funny because elsewhere he mentions that Bobus sneaks horse meat into his sausages. So he's not even a good sausage maker.
He's not even a good sausage maker.
Yeah. Furious, any thoughts?
Firstly, I have to say I did like his reference here to about what is, I just lost the line just now, but more or less the ability of, where he says, you know, what is the ability of one of these people to be elected other than their ability to be elected, which in essence is sort of criticizing the notion of the people who get put up in, you know, democracies to become representatives of people. You know, what skill do they possess other than the ability to be elected and to sort of portray the qualities in order to make that process as smooth and as assured as possible, rather than actually possessing, say, wisdom in the context, say, if you look at, say, the Athenian notion of, you know, government by philosophers, you know, government by wisdom, which, okay, you can break that down and discuss that as a principle or a potential, you know, former government, for good or for better or for worse. But at the, you know, in the end, what he's sort of saying here is that we're sort of getting a, you know, a sausage maker who'll put anything into his sausage to appeal to people who consume sausages, in a sense. You know, it's very base, isn't it?
Yeah, and he has another essay in Latter Day Pamphlets called "Stump Orator," where he looks at like the sheer emptiness and lack of substance. Basically, says that like a politician will get up there and say the sorts of things that journalists like. I mean, you know, more things. Yeah, I mean,
hence why they're the best of friends, politicians and journalists, for the most part.
Yeah, and then literally dropping fatness, you know, basically if you throw enough fat into the mincer, you know, people are going to appreciate your sausage, you know, larding your words.
That's another thing that old Bobus does, D. He masks the fact that he's using like old fat by putting a grey pepper spice to kind of
to put on
to mask the lack of quality in his product.
Exactly. Yeah. Any final thoughts, D, before we wrap this up?
Yeah, well, we've mostly covered it, but you know, again, I mean, this sort of brilliance of bringing in a character like this. I mean, especially to get to use a word like verbissimus, you know, is again a wonderful Carlyleism. These terms, but I think it certainly does show his skepticism about what we've sort of been led to reverence, this idea of, you know, the primacy of the free market, and that of course that by the market all the best will rise to the top, you know, and of course in the case of a sausage maker, what's going to rise at the top is all the rancid fat, you know. I think that there's something very clever there, and it's something really for a lot of the kind of right to think about, because as I said, we've been conditioned to think that that as people on the right we're supposed to sort of reverence industriousness and the ability to make wads of cash as a virtue, and indeed that may not be a virtue at all.
He elsewhere he calls this idea like pig philosophy, you know, an immeasurable swine's trough in which paradise is seen as the unlimited attainability of pigs' wash. And of course, in a society like that, you are going to get the Bobus Higginses and the Hudsons and so on, you know, as the people at the top. The other thing that he said that I came across recently related to this actually made me think of some of the Tory boys, not mentioning any names in particular, where their conception of life itself. He talks about this character, yet another kind of whipping boy that he sets up, called McCrowdy, who's a professor of the dismal science. You know, he's an economics professor, but a completely morally bankrupt character. And he says, in McCrowdy's eyes, the universe is not the living garment of God, but a huge, dull cattle stall and St. Catherine's Wharf, with a few pleasant apartments upstairs for those that can make money. And to me, that was a very succinct kind of summing up almost of what still remains really the kind of the Boris Johnson view of the world, or the, you know, the vanishing point view of the world, or the view of the world that we're all encouraged, quote, on the right to have. And it's bankrupt. It's just an empty, it's like, oh, great. You know, it's just more stuff at the end of the day. And as anyone who's made a bit of money will know, D, it's just stuff at the end of the day. It's like, I mean, what can it get you, really?
Yeah, other than to stuff your sausage, so to speak.
Yes. Well, what I said about stuffing sausages, the better.
or to stuff your stomach with someone else's poor quality sausage.
Yeah, indeed. All right, well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We have Curtis Yarvin coming up. And I hope you enjoy the rest of Carlisle Day. And thank you very much, Dee and Furious. It was a good discussion.